Welcome to the New Books Network.
From Brandeis University, welcome to Recall This Book. I'm Elizabeth Ferry, and I'm here with my co-host, John Potts. Hi, John.
Hello.
And with our guest, Daniel Solalis, who's an anthropologist and associate professor in the Department of Management, Politics, and Philosophy in the Copenhagen Business School. He's the author of Songs of Profit, Songs of Loss, Private Equity, Wealth, and Inequality, which was published in 2019 by the University of Nebraska Press. Hello, Dan.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
We're delighted you're here. So we're going to talk with Dan about his work on private equity and generally about related issues of financialization and inequality and whatever happened to the Occupy movement and sundry other things. So
maybe we'll even get to the monastery at some point.
Oh, yes. And get to the monastery,
too. It all comes back.
Yes. Actually, I'll say, Dan, that one of the things I really like about your work is your writing style and your sort of way of weaving the description of your methods into a narrative form. So,
thanks for that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, why don't you tell us about the book? And if you want to start a little bit about the monastery, that would be actually a good.
Yeah. It's fun. So the monastery actually is a great place to start. I wanted to go to a group of people who were trying to live according to what God told them to do, because I thought it was an interesting question, because you can't really ask God directly. I don't know. So I thought, that would be a good thing to study, the way a community makes sense of the will of the divine. But what ended up happening was, this was actually a couple of years after the financial crisis in 2007, 2008. And these monks, they weren't like entrepreneurs. They weren't like real active monks. They were hermits. And so a lot of their income came from donations and an endowment, and it just got absolutely hammered in the financial crisis. And so, something like 50% of their income was coming through investments. And so they were in a bit of a crisis. They'd actually just built an infirmary to take care of old sick monks on the monastery. So there was a real estate element of it. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to get more donations. And like, to do this, they decided they needed to be like a better charitable destination. And so they had a bunch of some sort of organizational and accounting consultants come in and try to like scrutinize and rationalize this order of monks that had been around for like 1,000 years. And towards the end of it, they were asking me to sort of explain what I was noticing to the consultant guys. And I sort of had this moment where it was like, oh, well, the God stuff is interesting. It's good to write about. I'd like to write about it at some point. But the real story here is these accountants coming in and like trying to rationalize this order of hermit monks and, mm-hmm. Put in an advisory board and try and reorganize their finances. And it was one of these moments where it's like, oh goodness, you can't even escape it here. So maybe this is what I should be paying attention to. And so when I got back to New York, Occupy Wall Street was happening. The years get a little blurry at this point, but it was happening at some point while I was in graduate school. Mm-hmm. I just decided that I should probably study the finance people that were pushing these monks around. And so that made me reorient to study up.
So I come from a 19th century perspective, and first flowering of liberalism, not neoliberalism. So we're familiar with a narrative of kind of everything that is solid melts into air, like everything gets financialized.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
So I guess my question for you is, because I was thinking about how resonant that anecdote of the monastery is at the beginning of your book, is your understanding of this something kind of like liberalism financialized almost everything, but then there were a few leftover places it didn't get around to, and now we're seeing them reaching even the monasteries? Is it that,
or is it something
different about what's distinctive about this like private equity moment, or the moment of like a kind of new form of financialization that you are perceiving, like, even in the monastery, you can see this new kind of valuing happening?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't actually have a good answer to that, because I know that there's an extremely long history of monasteries and how they finance themselves and how they fit into their communities. Mm-hmm. My take on this particular house, though, was founded in the 50s and kind of benefited a lot from the counterculture wave in the 50s and 60s. Huh. And this was sort of like a little kind of Catholic version of this, where people were going in back to the land, that kind of thing. It happened in the West. And like a lot of the biographies of the monks that I got sort of pointed in that direction. Like this was kind of a back to the land, back to basics, monasticism as an alternative way of living. And the way like these generations like rhythmically move through monasteries, that was still the generation that was by and large running the place when I got there. I mean, there were some younger guys that had come in, but it had very much been established in this sort of 60s and 70s moment. And I don't think you'd be unwarranted in sort of expanding it to the last to the rest of society, where it's like financialization wasn't that big a governing factor in a lot of societal institutions. It was sort of that post-war moment where it's more corporatism, of large corporate forms, some version of the post-war welfare state, as opposed to atomizing everything. And that was my read on the monastery.
Got it.
But it's kind of a naive one, because I don't have that much comparative material for you.
That's interesting, though, because when you were asking that question, John, I was thinking about liberalism and neoliberalism and this kind of tension between, it comes out very clearly in your book and is clearly at the heart of the monastery question too, between sort of business as producing things and then, the role of finance as sort of extracting value. So sort of a productive and an extractive form of capitalism, you could call it. To me, you can also see going from, and I'm sure, certainly before too, but going from the 19th century through the 20th century, kind of an oscillation of, even when you think of the sort of debates over the greenbackers and the bullionists, right? Like those were debates between farmers and Wall Street financiers and so on, right? And then there's these kind of high points of corporatism where there's a kind of, much more industrial manufacturing kind of base. So I guess I'm trying out on both of you the idea of maybe this is a story of a kind of oscillation or an ebb and flow, although perhaps within that, each time there's an ebb of financialization, it's like the wave goes a bit higher on the beach or something.
Yeah, it kind of outdoes itself, or it has to accumulate more to make up for whatever wedge it's putting itself into.
Yeah, I totally take your point, Elizabeth, but just using the word extractive there, I guess I would, my 19th century return to this, but we don't have to dwell there, is that the extractive as opposed to the productive, to me also seems like one of those questions, like within the, basically farming enters into the industrial economy. It becomes part of the metaphor of like renewing and flourishing. Like even interest on money is seen like crop renewal, like Willa Cather is full of images where money and wheat seem like basically the same thing. But the extractive is actually a slightly different metaphor, isn't it? Because the extractive goes to this notion that what we're doing is like sort of cracking the earth open to get what we can. I mean, that's a kind of colonial or imperial, that's like a resource extraction.
Yeah, I was being a little sloppy there. What I meant was in the sense of like extracting value from the interstices of the financial system.
I see. Yeah, yeah.
So the rents on currency exchange or the the fees that are coming from these leverage buyouts that we read about in the Barbarians at the Gate.
I think that the Barbarians at the Gate, though, is an interesting case in this, right? Because, the irony of that book, which is about, the biggest leverage buyout that ever happened, maybe until a year or two ago.
Yeah, and give our listeners a one sentence reminding of the buyout.
Yeah, it was RJR Reynolds. So it was the company that makes Oreos. And at the time it was merged with a company that made cigarettes. And so it was this massive, massive conglomerate. And its stock was, according to some theories of corporate valuation, severely undervalued. And so H. Ross Johnson, the CEO at the time, tried to orchestrate a management-led buyout. But then he got outfoxed by some of the first private equity investors, and they bid up and they bid up and they bid up. And this book is about the conflict between these two ways of seeing the company. But like the irony of it is okay, the barbarians at the gate. So it's like we're civilized on the inside here, but the barbarians are out there. And it's like, okay, the private equity guys are supposed to be the barbarians because they're going to come in and smash up this corporation. They're going to move people around. They're going to sell everything. But like, you know, the corporate management that was running this conglomerate was exceedingly decadent. I mean, and that's one of the crazy things about the book. It's like it's described in gratuitous detail that, you know, there's a fleet of like a dozen airplanes, corporate jets that he's flying around and flying.
And sponsoring golf tournaments and, and you have like 20, you're like a member of like 20 different country clubs and stuff. So
But wait, I don't get it. That still works because then if you're the decadent Romans, then I mean, decadents aren't barbarians. They're decadents. It's different.
No,
I mean,
you're hanging out in the vomitorium, but you're not.
It's
true. Now, link this to your project, because one of the things I think is great about your book is that you really kind of capture some of the tensions within private equity that are sort of, you know, there's this aspect of it that is saying, well, we're not venture capitalists and we're really looking for, you know, to improve management and to improve companies. And then there's another dimension, which is much more, you know, perceived as negative by you
and those
others. So just tell us, sketch for us the study that you did.
Sure. Yeah. So I wanted to answer a very basic question. Why and how do private equity investors buy, manage, and sell the companies that they do? And so what I did for 2 years is I just chased private equity investors around mostly the East Coast of the United States. So I interviewed them, I went to their offices, I went to their conferences, and I just wanted to understand what they did and how they understood what they did. And one of the things that that was key to understanding what they did was exactly what you're describing, Elizabeth. It's this idea that they are responsible stewards of capital. They deal with mature, important companies. They take them under ownership for, you know, 3 to 10 years, and then they sell them at a profit. And in their heads, if something is worth more when you sell it on the end of it than when you bought it, you've created value, you've improved it, you've done something good to society. And, you know, key to this too is sort of their reference group. So like they compare themselves to other financiers. So as compared to, you know, the swindling middlemen that work in an investment bank, they are noble and honorable. And compared to the venture capitalists that want to smash our society and chase the next big thing and don't care about the returns on their investors, they are responsible and you should trust them with your money. Yeah. And as compared to greedy, self-interested managers like, you know, H. Ross Johnson from RJR Nabisco, they will manage your capital such that investors and shareholders get their money back. And so like they see all of these people as their reference group and they're virtuous by comparison.
Let me bring us back a little bit to the idea of the self-conception and the kind of cultural affective texture of it, because one of the things that was really cool about your book, and this is a little bit of insider baseball, but you know, Dan is situating himself within a broader field of anthropology of finance, and one of his interventions has been to kind of say, well, hold on, not all finance is the same. There's a very well-known book called Liquidated by Karen Ho, which is, I think, is an excellent book, but is sometimes taken as describing an entire, describing Wall Street. And you know, one of the things that's interesting about Dan's work has been a sort of differentiation about sort of what's going on with the investment bankers that are in Ho's study and the private equity. One way to think about this is Karen Ho has this idea of smartness. So like being a, you know, and smartness is like a very clear meritocratic thing, right? It's like, it's so, you know, it's experienced as this kind of naturally occurring in, you know, inherent quality of a person, but it so happens that it's only people who go to Harvard, Princeton, and Stanford, and maybe who have it, right? So there's like, And I was
it's what gets you into a Michael Lewis book, right? Is that
exactly.
That or saying that all those other guys are dumb. Like there's well, the two roles the for the Michael Lewis book.
Because, you know, so Dan has this very, in your book, you have this very good, you know, very specific kind of comparison of like, where do people come from? Like what institutions do they come from? And within private equity, it's a little looser. It's not as clear, right? You can actually go to the University of Oklahoma and become like a high, you know, super rich. And what I noticed was, and I wanted to ask you, is it's more like scrappiness. It's not so much smartness, it's more like scrappiness. So can you talk to us about what is scrappiness for these private equity people? And does it have any, does it buy into a meritocracy, or is it anti-meritocratic? And I partly say this because you talked about Seamus Khan's book, Privilege, which we've now talked about several times. Is it a form of sprezzatura, which we discussed?
Yeah, I read that essay. I enjoyed that. One of the differences is in socialization and is in background. And, you know, one way to think about socialization are the institutions that you pass through, but you can still end up a private equity investor. And like, you know, in the account that you get out of Liquidated, it's like the elite universities are very, very formative of expectations and personal identity and a pipeline. My reflection on this is that, like, I think that's true for a subset of financial firms. And I think it's more true at the beginning of your career than at the end of your career. But finance is so, so, so much bigger than the aggregate, you know, undergraduate graduating classes of the Ivy League universities. Like, you couldn't staff finance, even if you took all the people from who graduated from Princeton in 1 year and like routed them to Wall Street. It's just, it's so much bigger. And something different is going on with private equity. I mean, there is this element of, we look at you coming from an investment bank. Well, to get into a private equity firm, there's a very small number of places that you can have worked prior, right? You can work in an investment bank. You can have worked as a management consultant, but you can also have worked as an accountant, and you can also have worked as a lawyer. And in some specialized private equity firms, you can have worked as a hard scientist or a doctor or a bench scientist.
Right, if it's like a health.
Yeah. And so accounting, I think, is actually an interesting route because as far as I know, like, you can't get a degree in accounting from Princeton, I don't think.
I doubt it. No.
Yeah, I don't think you can. Yeah, I don't think you can do that from Harvard. So like, but that is a route into private equity. Being a sort of an accountant. It's not a majority route, but like I saw people with those backgrounds. And so the person who has a degree in accounting, they might've gone to like Penn State or something like that, which is not a cauldron of like elite social formation. In the larger American scene where maybe a third of people go to even an undergraduate, it's more elite than the average population, but it's not like this stratospheric thing. And yet those people still work with the people that have gone through the crucible of like Goldman Sachs and Princeton and that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of open questions I have about like how they actually negotiate whatever sort of work culture they have. And like the degree to which elitist meritocracy is really what's going on. And I think you're pointing to scrappiness is you're identifying something that's more important. It's like this workhorseness or this capacity to do this financial labor. And there, you know, it wasn't a common thing, but I would come into contact with people who were like, oh, I don't want to hire someone from like a prep school background, right? I wouldn't want to hire the boss's kid who was privileged.
I mean, you sort of said it just now, because like, you know, when we were talking about smartness, you said, well, or you're, you know, you get in because you think those people are stupid, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like oppositional, you know, street smarty kind of quality scrappiness that is a little different.
I mean, at this point, I can't tell if this is my own prejudice or me remembering correctly the ethnographic evidence, but like, I don't think the private equity guys think what they're doing is like rocket science. I mean, there are sophisticated financial things that go into leverage buyout deals. Like, you can make them extremely complicated, the way you structure stock, the way you structure the debt. But like, I don't I don't know. Maybe they do think it's complicated. It could be a thing to revisit, but it's not like, I don't know.
What are the analogies they use to describe what they're doing? Like, do they talk about it like putting on a musical? Do they talk about it like a football game? Do they talk about, I mean, I feel like there are things that, you know, that sort of give you an insight into what operations people think they're really good at, or, you know, what, I mean, they're pulling
they
off.
Say they're doing deals. Yeah. And they're not much given to figurative talk. You know, yeah. I picked up some metaphorical references here and there. I mean, one that I thought was really funny was I was interviewing a guy who used to be a very fancy consultant, and he was probably in his early 30s working in a private equity firm. And it was a small private equity firm and had an industry niche focus. And I asked him, I said, hey, you know, who do you like to hire? Right. Just very basic. And he's like, oh, we like to hire athletes. And I was like, oh, cool. So like you hire like college basketball players and football players and stuff like that. And then his face just froze and he was like aghast. He's like, oh God, no. Like he couldn't imagine hiring that type of athlete. What he meant was the metaphorical brain athletes. And like, that's who was coming in. And I thought it was so funny because it was like, yeah.
Yeah.
But like you would pick this metaphor for like peak performance that is the furthest away from what you're actually doing to describe. Like the one thing you can't do with all of your money is play basketball.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. But I mean, like in the barbarians at the gate, to me, it seems like fighting. I mean, it's like it's like war and fighting.
Yeah.
Wasted. They're kicking our ass. They're murdering us. And also there's a whole like betrayal kind of like we're getting used. So those seem to be implicitly metaphors about.
I think that like that realm of metaphor is still alive. But the thing about Barbarians at the Gate is it's kind of at the beginning of private equity. So they're smashing lots of norms and it's been routinized to a degree that people kind of know what to expect now when private equity shows up. And it was hostile. Like it went to an auction and the private equity guys don't want that because when things go to auction, prices go up. So, you know, the avatars of capitalism don't want that form of competition.
So this is a hard question to get at exactly, but where do people think, the people who are, you are studying, do they think of what they are doing as like a noble vocation and profession, like my ethical life is in doing this? Or do they think of it as like kind of value neutral and I find like meaning elsewhere? Like because I feel like there's a stereotype, you know, there's like a lot of professors who are like zealots, right? Like we actually think what we do in the classroom is like this noble calling. And then there's people who are like, no, I mean, it's just what I do. And then, you know, but I find my meaning elsewhere.
Right.
Does that make sense? Is that?
Yeah. I mean, my take on it is a both and. They're able to participate in both registers, and many of them vacillate. And it depends on the context and who they're talking to and where they're at in their career. And they're absolutely able to participate and understand both registers. And they probably place themselves, like most people, one side or the other, depending on how things are going.
Have you guys read that great book, Confessions of a Stock Jobber? That book from the 1920s.
Oh no!
It's some famous guy who played the stocks, but he started in bucket shops and moved his way up. But there's just these super poignant moments where he tries to go on vacation to Atlantic City, I think he goes, and he just can't. He like sneaks away from his wife and the party because he hates to just go to, I think literally to a bucket shop to place a bet, you know, because he's convinced that he's got a kind of new way of thinking here at the beach. And it's just very moving and sad at the same time, you know.
Well, it's like the addictiveness of it, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an element too that the socialization to make it in this universe really closes off your ability to have other things that can generate meaning in your life. So if you spend from graduation, you know, if you spend from like the time you're 21 to the time you're 35 on this very rigid track, you're working 60, 70 hours a week, all the relationships that don't have to do with finance, they wither and die.
Yeah.
Your reference group becomes the people that you work with, and your measures of success becomes that of your reference group. And so it would take someone really exceptional to have something outside of that that could ground them. I mean, kind of in the same way that you were describing, you know, maniacal academics.
Right. And also, I mean, your sleep cycle is completely screwed. Your nutritional, you know,
the way you access the city, the way you access leisure, the way you go to restaurants, the way you interact with, you know, potential, you know, marriage or romantic partners, all of it gets, you know, pushed down that funnel.
Yeah, I mean, I think those scenes in Barbarians of the Cave of the empty Chinese food containers and the pencils that are in the ceiling because they're like throwing pencils up in the ceiling. I love that part. So,
well, isn't that the point of American Psycho? Like, isn't that the logic of American Psycho? Like, if you get that, and I mean, it's not okay, fine, he's a psycho, yes, but I mean, it's more just like he just sees the world through this one particular prismatic set of lenses, which he's been acculturated to. And then,
I mean, the book is not called Psycho, it's called American Psycho, right?
I mean, I was sitting down with a guy at one point when I was doing the private equity work. And, you know, one of the things that private equity does is they come in, they buy the company, and then they structure compensation packages for executives such that they force the executives to do what the private equity guys want, right? And usually this is maximizing short-term profits so you can pay down all the debt that got put on the company in the transaction. And I said, how are you incentivizing managers to do this? Like, what are the professional incentives that you give them? And he's like, what do you mean? And I said, well, how do you make them do this? And he's like, well, we pay them more.
Right.
And I said, do you do anything else? And he said, well, what else could you do for someone? Like, so there's nothing you could do for another human being aside from give them money.
Right. Which is why this is like an engine of inequality, right? Because then there's the golden parachutes, and then the debt, you know, financing has to come from the people who are lower down on the.
It's like a pyramid.
Hierarchy, right.
So Elizabeth, you wanted to make a connection to the our Brahmin left conversations. Do you want to say more about how you were thinking of that connection?
You know, a series that we did on the Brahmin left, which came out of a conversation that John Adenir had with Thomas Piketty, was about the sort of, you know, predicaments of inequality and their political fallout, particularly within the party system, right? And, you know, there are various iterations, and we have kind of we're scrappy about them. But, you know, central to that is this kind of pivotal moment of the, you know, of the financial crisis, and this moment that I think we all remember, or at least I remember, as like, oh, this moment of potential opening and like solidarity and, you know, we are the 99%, is this little Gramscian, you know, space opening up. I think that our undergraduates barely remember Occupy at all. So, you know, I'm just curious what you think, Dan, as having looked at this stuff closely, like what happened with Occupy as, you know, something where these things really were on the table for conversation?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I kind of take David Graeber's perspective on this one, where he thinks about revolutions as changes in ideas of common sense. And I think, you know, I think it's fair to say, okay, yeah, we're still living with financialized capitalism. But I think at least for those of us who were around to remember it, I think it changed a lot of our common sense about the structure of society, and it put inequality on the political agenda in a way that hasn't gone away. And the fact that we haven't had effective political mobilizations to create like a socialist utopia in America, sure, that's disappointing, but you know, it's the American political system is designed to prevent that type of majoritarian action. So it's, you know, it's upsetting, but I really do think that there's been a change in attitude around how people think about debt, how people moralize debt. And I don't think anyone thinks that finance people are good guys. You know, I don't think...
that's a hopeful stance. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. So, you know, has it translated into the type of political action that I would like? Obviously not. But yeah, I think that, I mean, for me, certainly, it was a change in consciousness. And I think it was for a lot of people that were around during it.
Well, can I ask the question a different way? Can I connect it back to Elizabeth, your, I thought, really interesting point. When you were splitting apart the different waves in the oscillation, you picked up, Dan, your point about corporatism and like waves of corporatism. Mm-hmm. So maybe the question has to do with like capacity of institutions or trust in institutions to solve problems, like moments when big government comes roaring back versus moments when neither the right or the left particularly wants big government. And clearly Occupy, the particularities of Occupy were like not wanting big government, right? I mean, it wasn't, it was seen as a dissident movement. But then, you know, like in the 30s, you got that kind of dissonance, 1930s, that is, you get that dissonance, and then you get a big government response to it. Like, we can solve this problem at a corporate level. And that's a, you know, a positive, like Piketty looks at that moment and he says, like, this is the moment in the 20s and 30s when suddenly people start having faith in institutions to be able to get us out of this, rather than, you know, just particularized, financialized state. We have a state with, you know, common stakeholders or something. So are we there in the 20s? Like, I don't see the turn back towards that faith. I mean, clearly it's not there on the right. I mean, obviously.
Yeah.
Well, I guess perversely, you could argue that ethno-nationalism is a form of faith and corporate
identity. Well, and I think that, you know, the call for regulation and stuff is a call for governmental.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like a big deal. I think it's a big deal that like Biden has nominated who he has to lead the Federal Trade Commission. I mean, Lena Khan has a very
infrastructure bill is about trying to have these governmental solutions. And I think that Dan, that is a sign potentially that you know these things are more on the table. The common sense has shifted.
I just think capital, like writ large and politically mobilized, has a huge interest in the only entity that is capable of regulating it and redistributing it being in disarray. And like, that's how you can read Republic. That's one way to read Republican politics. And that's often how I choose to read it. It's, you know, the intentional disruption and dismantling of the state, because if it is captured by interests that are hostile to capital, it will regulate capital, it will break up monopolies, and it will redistribute wealth. And it will do so fairly quickly because most people want that.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Dan. It was a great conversation. And we will have more commentary and other things around all of these questions, both the methods questions and sort of finance, what happened to Occupy, and so on. So
yeah, well, this is super fun. Thank you both for having me on. I really enjoy the work you're doing, and it's a nice conversation.
Excellent. Thank you. So Recall, this book is the brainchild of John Plotz and Elizabeth Ferry. It's affiliated with Public Books and is recorded with the help of the Media Lab of the Brandeis Library. Our music comes from a song by Eric Chaslow and Barbara Cassidy called Fly Away. Sound editing is by Naomi Cohen, and production assistant, including website design and social media, is done by Miranda Peary. We appreciate the support of the Mandel Center for the Humanities at Brandeis, University Librarian Matthew Sheehy, and Dean Dorothy Hodgson. We always want to hear from you with your comments, criticisms, and suggestions for future episodes, and you can email us directly or contact us via social media and our website. Finally, if you enjoyed today's show, please be sure to write a review or rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You may be interested in checking out past episodes, especially Christine DeSands on making money, Peter Brown on wealth and charity in early Christianity, kind of another monastery connection, and our series on the so-called Brahmin left. And please stay tuned in our next season for episodes produced in partnership with the podcast Novel Dialogue and more. So thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next time.